Thank you very much, Vajratara. So, one of the most important aspects, if you like, of Buddhist practice, Buddhist spiritual life, is the engagement of emotion. The engagement of emotion. This is really very important. There's a saying of our teacher, Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, that the central issue for most people in the spiritual life is to find emotional equivalence for intellectual understanding. To find emotional equivalence for intellectual understanding. We all know that we should love people, that we should be generous, we should be kind, we should, live a good life and all the rest of it. But emotionally, very often we just don't follow through with that. Very often we just don't bring our emotions into our spiritual practice. And really all Buddhist traditions are very concerned with that in one way or another. But within the Vajrayana, the Tantra, which is the theme we're concerned with at the moment in the talks we're looking at the moment, in Tantric literature, in Tantric practice, in a way this is one of the really, probably it's the issue. One way you can look at it is in terms of energy. Tantric Buddhism is very concerned with energy. In a way, they'd argue that one of the reasons why we don't make progress is that we just haven't got our energy involved sufficiently in the task of spiritual transformation. Our energies are too dissipated, or they're too stuck, or they're not refined enough, they're not positive enough, they're not concentrated enough. So emotion and energy very often go together. So bear that in mind as we go through this talk. Tonight I'm going to be referring to no one tantric Buddhist text. And I'm very much concerned with tantric Buddhist texts now within the Tibetan context. What I've got in mind is a lot of different literature from Tibetan Buddhism associated with this figure that I've put on the shrine here. This is Padmasambhava, the lotus-born. Very often known by Tibetans as Guru Rinpoche, the greatly precious guru or teacher, who was from somewhere in northwest India, probably a region that's now part of Pakistan, Udayana, Urgyen, but who was hugely influential in the transmission of Buddhist tradition to Tibet. And we'll be referring to that in a bit more detail. So this is Guru Rinpoche. As you can see, he's, I don't know if you can make him out, but you can come and have a look later. He's a very impressive figure. Typically, he's depicted with this, what's called a wrathful smile. So he's smiling, but there's a sort of touch of wrath, or at least some energy in the expression. And here he's got in his right hand a vajra, a sort of diamond scepter or diamond thunderbolt. And there's a little blue demon that's bowing down to him. A little blue demon bowing down to Padmasambhava. So this is a very, very important image and very much associated with the story that I'm going to begin with this evening. And then having told that story, we'll need to draw some conclusions for that for our own practice. Because the whole point of any talks at this centre, yes, we'll be referring to Buddhist history, Buddhist tradition, but how does that impact on our practice here and now, here in Sheffield or wherever we're from, wherever we are? How does that impact? What are the lessons we can draw from that for the task of transformation, spiritual transformation here and now? So we have to go back to 8th century Tibet. This is the literature that I'm going to be looking at, the material that emerged in later centuries, but it describes 8th century Tibet, particularly a text called The Testament of Padma, The Testament of Padmasambhava. That's one of the famous texts that I'm going to be referring to. And what this tells of, it tells the story of the Tibetan king Trisong Detsen. Trisong Detsen was a very powerful king in the 8th century, and Tibet was something of an empire at that time. Parts of China were part of the Tibetan Empire, very significantly. And Tibet had a lot of power, a lot of influence. And Trisong Detsen's forebears, the kings before him, had started to have a bit of Buddhism going on. Tibetan sort of religion, if you can recall it that, was a kind of animistic tradition, I suppose you can call it. It was called the Bun. And there was a lot of worship of nature spirits and very, very superstitious people. Lots of concern about ghosts and ghouls and things like that. It's a very primordial sort of place, Tibet, and still is, even with the Chinese occupation. But Trisong Detsen wanted to take it further. He really was inspired by Buddhism, and he wanted Buddhism to become very, very established and taken very seriously. In fact, he wanted it to be the state religion. That's the way he was thinking. There was a lot of opposition to that from his ministers who were wedded to the old ways, but he was very powerful, and he said, right, we're going to have a monastery. We're going to build a monastery. That's what we need. We need a place where people can practice Buddhism together, where people can, we can have full-timers, and where all the people can come for instruction and teaching and so on. So he invited to Tibet a great Indian teacher named Shantarakshita. Shantarakshita, whose name means protected by peace, protected by the peace of Nirvana. He was a great scholar, Shantarakshita, a great, very holy man. In fact, he's known as the Bodhisattva abbot, because he was a Bodhisattva, is a very compassionate and wise being in Buddhist tradition. And Shantarakshita was famous not just for his learning, but for his kindness. So he came to Tibet and he started to teach. He started to ordain Tibetan monks and nuns and started to teach Buddhism, and the monastery at a place called Samye, which means the glorious, started to be built. So it's all going along very nicely. Nice bit of Buddhism going on, a nice place for everybody to come together. But weird things started to happen. The builders would build in the day, and in the morning they'd turn up and the whole place had been taken apart. So, you know, they'd build it, and then the next day what they'd built had been dispersed. It was a really weird situation. In fact, what was going on was that the men were building in the day, and at night the gods and spirits and demons of the Tibetan soil were taking the monastery apart. So the wise Bodhisattva told Trisong Detsen this. He said, there's something going on here. It must be the gods of the soil, the gods of the water, the gods of the air, the gods of Tibet. They don't want this. And so the king said, well, what can be done? What can we do about this? I want this monastery. It's very important for the future of Tibet, very important for the future of the world. So Shantarakshita said, well, I'm perfected in kindness and compassion. You actually need another kind of character. You need somebody who can use different methods to deal with these forces. Very different methods. And there's only one man who can help. There's a man in India named Padmasambhava. And he is famous for his conversion and subjugation of gods and demons. He's famous for that. You know, he's protected Buddhist sites from all sorts of malevolent forces. He's tamed and transformed all sorts of different beings. He spent much of his life in the great cremation grounds of India, teaching these weird creatures known as the Darkanese, who you know, do all sorts of strange and macabre things. He's brought them to Buddhist tradition. He's just a brilliant teacher, a brilliant teacher. Everybody, you know, thinks he's wonderful, except those who've got on the wrong side of him. Invite him. So Trisong Detsen thought, well, we've just got to have this man. So delegations were sent off to India, and it wasn't easy to find this character, Padmasambhava, a very mysterious character with his long hair and his, you know, little moustache and beard, and you know, he was sort of a bit kind of liminal on the kind of Buddhist scene. Nobody quite knew where he'd turn up next. Bit of a shapeshifter, a bit of a strange, mysterious, fascinating character. People weren't even quite sure about him. Some people, he's kind of got a bit of a dodgy reputation. One of these sorts of characters, but very interesting sort of character. But eventually the Tibetans, these young Tibetans, they found him. And Padmasambhava eventually said, okay, I'll come. I'll come and do this. And so they went off. But Padmasambhava, before he went right into the heart of Tibet, he spent a whole year in the mountains and valleys and by the sacred lakes of of Tibet, meditating. And while he was meditating, what was going on? He was having encounters with the great gods of Tibet. And it's an extraordinary passage in the Testament of Padma and in other literature describing this, where these different gods, they know something is going on. They know somebody's come into their realm who's very threatening. They know that there's this new, benignly magical force of Buddhist Dharma that's come there, that's very, very powerful. And they are rattled. They are seriously rattled by it. So they manifest in all sorts of forms to frighten him away. There's the story of Shangpo, who manifests as a giant yak. You know, yaks are the sort of Tibetan animal, you know, really sort of shaggy head and horns and all the rest. This huge yak that fills a valley and breathing blizzards onto Padmasambhava. And Padmasambhava just stands there, just looking, making strange gestures with his hands and brandishing his thunderbolt. And that makes Shangpo dissolve and turn into a beautiful youth. A beautiful youth who bows. And another figure, a goddess, a really malevolent goddess, who rises up into space and lets forth her thunderbolts and lightning flashes to destroy Padmasambhava. And he gets hold of her, plunges her down into a lake, and then makes the lake start to boil. So she rises up, is just a skeleton. He blinds her in one eye, and of course she calms down and turns into a benign form, gives him a treasure, and vows to follow him, and so on. And there's another group of characters. They're called the Tinglo Men Visages, and they seem to be a sort of army of gnomes who sort of all come marching out. You know, and they're breathing sort of flames at the guru, and he freezes them. Very interesting little detail as well. Every time he deals with these demonic forces, every time he deals with them, they say they give them the heart. They gave him the heart of their life. They gave him the heart of their life, and they vowed to protect the Buddhist tradition. This phrase, the heart of their life, is another way you could translate it as their seed mantra, their seed syllable. You know, in this world of magic, everybody, everything has a sort of secret name, which is the heart of their life, which is like a mantra, like a sound, like a heart sound, a heart essence. And that's them. So when they give it, when they give that their secret name, their special name to Padmasambhava, that means they've surrendered, if you like. He has, as it were, power over them. But they vow to become not hostile anymore to the benign forces of Buddhist tradition, but to protect it and serve it. So they're not destroyed. This is very important. They're not obliterated. They become supporters. They become benign forces protecting the tradition of spiritual development. It is very important that Padmasambhava doesn't destroy them, he transforms them. Eventually, he meets the king, and that's a very interesting part of the testament of Padmasambhava, because there's a kind of standoff. The king, although he wants Buddhism in his country, is incredibly proud. And he wants Padmasambhava to bow to him, but Padmasambhava's thinking, no, I don't bow to you. You bow to the Dharma. And right now, I am the Dharma. You know, Padmasambhava had no false modesty. He knew what he was, and he knew what the king was. And eventually the king did bow, but only after Padmasambhava had sung this fantastic song describing his attainment. If you want to hear more about that particular kind of standoff, listen to there's a very good talk that Vajratara gave on that, which is in the Sheffield Buddhist Centre Library. Well worth listening to. But eventually, Padmasambhava was accepted in, and they got down to this task of building the monastery. One of it wasn't completed, this as conversion of the local gods. There's a very important group of deities called the Nagas. The Nagas are the sort of serpent deities of the waters and all the growing things in the land. And the waters, of course, has lots of gold and gems within it. And part of the growing things are all the great trees. And, you know, they need the wood to build the monastery. And Padmasambhava had to do a lot of work converting the Nagas, meditating on the Nagas, bringing them into the Dharma. And there's lovely stories of Padmasambhava meditating by a lake, transforming himself into a kind of eagle, a Garuda, the Indian eagle, and meditating on kind of eating snakes, because that's what the Indian eagle does, it eats snakes. And then the gold being washed up on the shore as the Nagas give up their gold and give up their wood for the building of the monastery. And again, vowing to support the Dharma, vowing to support the growth of the Dharma in Tibet. So these are the sort of stories. These are the stories that we have. I know it might sound a bit strange. You might think, well, isn't Buddhism a sort of loving, peaceful religion? Well, it is. But Buddhism does have to engage with these forces. Tibetans themselves describe themselves as the land of the red-faced savages who are fond of eating meat, who are fond of fighting, who are very bloodthirsty. This is the kind of world that the Tibetans say of themselves. So they needed somebody who could meet that very, very strong energy in there and bring it on, bring it into Buddhist practice. And it seems it all went wonderfully in the 8th century. Eventually the monastery was built. Eventually Padmasambhava and all the other great teachers could be there, could teach Buddhism. People could come there and practice. And the great tradition of Buddhism in Tibet could really flourish and grow and continue to grow. Although, interestingly enough, at that time, sometimes the king or his ministers or something like that would go against Padmasambhava's instructions. And different gods would sort of rise up again, you know, would keep rising up, interrupting the flow of the Dharma, the flow of Buddhism in the country. And Padmasambhava gave all sorts of warnings about this, that, well, you know, because this is going on, because you're not cooperating, this is going to lead to problems in the future. And it's interesting, a lot of Tibetan history is full of problems. It's not as wonderful as we can often think it is. Anyway, what I really want to dwell on is this business of transforming gods or demons, making them into protectors of the Dharma. This is the theme. And remember this whole thing of transformation of our emotion, transformation of energy, so it serves our practice of the Dharma. So we've got to start identifying in our individual experience and also in our collective experience, what are the powerful gods and forces that we need to get on board if our Buddhist practice is going to have any kind of energy and power, if you like, if it's going to be vivid enough. It's a very, very interesting question. And, you know, what are our gods? Because it seems a bit strange to be talking about this, you know, in such a kind of materialistic environment where we've had all the kind of onslaughts of, you know, science and materialism. You know, where are our gods? Where are they? What do we bring on board? Actually, the gods are everywhere. They haven't gone away. We might think that we live as, you know, very rational beings and so on, but actually the gods are really having a very powerful effect on the way we run our lives. There's a very interesting passage in one of the very early Buddhist scriptures, actually, where the Buddha sees powerful deities influencing men to build a great city. You know, we assume that it's us human beings that are running everything, but there probably are much deeper forces than we realize, creating our world, creating our environment. And we've got to really engage with these and look at these and become more conscious of these so that they're included within our spiritual practice. So what are our gods? What are they? What can we look at? Well, there's a few I've been pondering as I've been giving this talk. And I suppose that one of the points to make about these things, these gods of Tibet who initially fought against the growth of the Dharma in Tibet, well, they seem demonic. They seem like enemies of Buddhist practice. They seem like enemies of our meditation, enemies of our spiritual growth. But they might have within them things that we can actually harness. So let's try to think of an example. First one is the god, and this isn't particular to perhaps to the modern world, it's a god or a demon that's everywhere. It's the god of desire. The god of desire. In Indian Buddhism you have this character called Mara, who embodies, who represents all the things that are, you know, that are obstacles to enlightenment. And one of the forms he manifests as is Kamadeva, which is the god of sexual desire, the god of romance, that whole territory. And, you know, it really can be sometimes that particular god can be a real demon when it comes to spiritual practice. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but there you are, you've taken up meditation. You go along to your Buddhist centre, you learn your meditation. Maybe you've come along to Buddhism, maybe a bit down in the dumps, life isn't going too well. But you take up metta bhavana, you take up mindfulness of breathing, you get involved with Buddhists, and there you are, you've got a nice regular meditation practice every day and everything's going along very, very nicely, and it's great, I'm feeling happy, and of course you're beginning to kind of glow a bit and you're seeing the world in a different way, everything's looking a bit brighter than it used to. And then one day you see someone or you meet someone and they look absolutely stunningly beautiful. Maybe there's somebody you've seen regularly, and then suddenly one day you see them and you think, wow, they are absolutely stunningly beautiful. And before you know it, you're completely obsessed by them. And bang goes your meditation. I mean, at first it's all right because you're sitting there in the metta bhavana thinking, so much love for the whole world. And you're thinking of this person. But then, especially if perhaps they reject your advances, or even if they don't, you get involved and maybe they're not as straightforward as you thought they were, bang goes your meditation. Can't meditate. It's really as if overnight, you know, the demons have come out and they're meditating. Woohoo! They're really, let's make it a little bit difficult. let's take it apart. You know. So this is the way this particular God can work, and we go through all sorts of traumas and difficulties and eventually kind of crawl back to our cushion and start meditating. But you know, this particular God, demon, Karma Deva, can be transformed, really does need to be transformed, really does need to be brought into the Dharma. You read some Buddhist literature, and it's as if you should not, you know, some Buddhist literature make it seem that beauty is sort of a bad thing. You might have even come across Buddhist texts where they talk about meditating on ugliness. You know, really looking at the most revolting things to put you off anything. But really, we need to train ourselves in beauty. We need to refine the sources of pleasure, if you like. We need to kind of make beauty a part of our spiritual life, our spiritual practice. This is why Buddhist art is so important. You know, why you've got this incredible tradition of Buddhist painting. In Tibetan Buddhism, all the Tanka paintings, all the scroll paintings of all the colourful Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all these different images, and why, you know, you've got in particularly in, well, all over the Buddhist world, poetry about the beauties of nature and landscape. It's in our own Buddhist tradition. Sangharakshita, our founder, wrote a book many years ago called The Religion of Art, where he's talking about art as a spiritual practice, both the appreciation of art and the practice of art as being central to spiritual practice. We need beauty in our lives, and we need to connect it with our spiritual ideals and with our spiritual endeavour. That's the way you can transform that particular God, so that God, if you like, starts to support your practice, doesn't sort of detract from your practice. Should be this sort of intense sort of appreciation of beauty. There are even higher states of consciousness in Buddhism, liberations, called the beautiful, where you enter a state of great, as it were, formless beauty. Nothing, nothing sort of, not like a sort of aesthete in a sort of weedy kind of way, but something very, very powerful, very, very stirring, very sublime, which has a tremendous transforming effect on your spiritual practice. You know, if you see your spiritual ideal as beautiful, well, your emotions flow towards it very strongly. And interestingly enough, Padmasambhava himself, for the Tibetans, becomes a sort of object of beauty. When you read, there's a lot of devotional literature to Padmasambhava. He's a visualized, imaged, meditated upon. And he's associated with a whole range of spiritual qualities. And some of these songs are of very, very great beauty. And the descriptions of him are of very great beauty. And this is all to transform, you know, this whole area, if you like, so that it serves us. Then another God or demon. How can we describe this demon? This is the economic demon. They wouldn't probably have had that word in old Tibet, but in a way, they needed gold. You know, I find it very significant that the Nagas give up their gold. What are they going to do with the gold? Well, the gold they use to go and buy wood from, you know, the traders at the other side of the Himalayas. That's what they did, because they needed wood for the monastery. The economic demon, who is, and for all I know, it might be a demoness. I mean, you know, why should, you know, something as, you know, why should the demons, why can't demonesses be bad ones as well? It's an equal opportunity talk. But the economic demon, very powerful in our modern world, extremely powerful, all pervasive. And you see people really struggling sometimes with their Buddhist practice. You know, and so many times I talk to people and they basically say, work is the problem in my life. They need to work to get money to live. You know, and it's a big, big problem, you know, to pay the bills, to, you know, put food on the table, not just for yourself, but for your loved ones, and so on and so forth. It's a very, very powerful demon. And of course, you know, it's creating a lot of anxiety at the moment with the state of world economics. It's an extraordinary demon. You know, I think it's very important to try and picture what this demon looks like. And because one of the things about demons is that they're kind of formless. You've got to try and get their form, identify them, so that you can actually do something with them. But the economic demon is very powerful. And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that there's some, you know, mantra that you can say that will sort out economics for you. But it's something to really be thought about, because we spend a lot of our time, you know, working, making a living. And a lot of the time that can really detract from what we're trying to do in meditation, what we're trying to do with our Buddhist practice. I was talking to somebody earlier, just talking about his workplace and what an uptight atmosphere it is and how kind of horrible it is. Well, you know, if you're spending your life in that environment, what's that doing to you? What's that doing to you? What effect is that having on your practice? I mean, I know people sometimes who are just exhausted from work. So it's really difficult to meditate, really difficult to go on retreat, really hard to kind of concentrate on what's really meaningful. So that's the thing, isn't it? You know, that we're trying to do something that's deeply meaningful with our lives, and yet we're spending hours and hours and days and months and years doing something which is really knackering us, which is really grinding us down. That is demonic. That is demonic, and we need to kind of look into it, face it, look right into it. Really think about it. I mean, this brings up the whole area. I mean, we've tried to address this. I remember years and years ago, Sangharakshita, when he gave a talk actually on this very subject, Padmasambhava, he said that when he first came to London, when he came back from India in the 1960s, somebody drove him through you know, the economic district of London, you know, Threadneedle Street, and, you know, all that, all where all the money institutions were. And he said, as he said that he felt this, you've got a man who's quite sensitive to atmospheres. And he said he found himself saying to the person he was with, "This is what needs to be transformed. This is what we're up against." You know, as if he felt the sort of presence of the, of, you know, what the Bible used to call Mammon, or what the Bible calls Mammon, as a very, very powerful demon. Mammon was this old god who loved gold. He's a fallen angel, but who loved, you know, money and gold. And one way we can start addressing at this is looking at all the teachings of Buddhism to do with what's called right livelihood, or even perfect livelihood. Trying to find a way of earning our money, of living, that serves our Buddhist practice. A way of earning our living which contributes to what's best in the world, in ourselves and in others. Maybe you've got that. Maybe this isn't an issue. Maybe this isn't a problem. But for some people, it most certainly is. And we've tried to look at this by creating businesses ourselves in our own movement, you know, where Buddhists work together, where they make money together as a team in a good environment, and the profits of which support the growth of the Dharma. But it's very difficult. You know, we've had successes with that, we've had failures with that, because this particular demon is a tough one, is a really difficult one. I mean, it's brilliant. If you go down into the town centre, we've got our evolution shop, and every time I pass that evolution shop, there's always a consciousness that is where the demon transformation activity is going on. You know, they're right in there, right in the heart of it, you know, involved in that energy, if you like, right parked in that energy, trying to sort of turn it around for the benefit of themselves and for the benefit of others. It's It's a very important area, this. And I know I've talked with some people here about looking at other ways of getting Buddhists to work together. Lots of people with so many talents and skills, and it would be great to draw people together more, you know, to have, you know, and be more imaginative with this whole topic of right livelihood. It doesn't have to be the patterns that we've used before. I mean, there could be new things that could be evolved, and so that your work is really your vocation. Your work is an expression of your Buddhist practice. Your work is an experience of spiritual community, rather than it being a source of strain and conflict. I mean, it will still be challenging. You know, working with other Buddhists isn't always easy, but at least you're engaging, you're wrestling with that particular demon. You're trying to get hold of its heart and turn it round so it supports your spiritual practice. So the economic demon is a very important area to engage with, to convert. The next area is, again, one that isn't, perhaps particular. It's a general one. And this is the demon of death and impermanence. Mara, that character I talked about, there's an aspect of Mara which is death. Death is a very frightening prospect for most people. And if it isn't, maybe it should be. But it's something that perhaps we kind of shy away from, the fact of our mortality, the fact of the mortality of others. But we are in the realm of death. You know, we're in the realm of life and death. And that particular... And because it's such a... an unknown area, because, you know, we can't remember previous lives, we can't remember having died before, but we contemplate this sort of, as it were, ending of things. Well, we need to start engaging with that without fear, without intimidation, without horror. We need to start looking that in the face much more clearly and taking the energy, if you like, that's around that into our spiritual life and spiritual practice. Many, many years ago, I lived in India, and I first went to India, I think it was in 1978, and it was the first time that I'd spent a long time. I spent 2 years there when I first went there, or 18 months when I first went there. And I'd hardly been out of England. I think I'd been to France for day trips or something. And I went to India to work for Buddhism. And I got a tremendous shock. I was only, 20, hadn't been ordained for very long. Very naive, very full of myself. And I got a tremendous shock, tremendous culture shock, because I was in such a different environment. But one of the things I was very strongly confronted with was death. In India, it's on the streets. It's on the streets. You see sick people. You see dead people. I saw my first dead body in India. Went to a live cremation in India. Saw a lot of poverty. Saw a lot of hardship. Saw a lot of decay. And it had it was a great shock for me. But it was very interesting when I was there. You know, one of the things that happens in your Buddhist practice is, and in your meditation, that sometimes images can present themselves very, very strongly. They press in on you. If you have any sort of imagination, they start to press on you in your dreams or even in your waking life. And the image that kept pressing itself on me at that time was a particular aspect of Padmasambhava, his sort of yogi aspect, his sort of very scantily clad, just wearing a sort of tiger skin and wearing bone ornaments, and with long hair and a sort of brownish body. It's a particular kind of form that he had. And this is associated with him dwelling in the cremation grounds, the old cremation grounds of India, which aren't weren't neat and tidy places. These were places where the dead are just brought and left to, you know, rot and pass away, or, you know, thrown into fires. And this particular form of Padmasambhava would dwell in these cremation grounds, and it said that here he would teach the Dharma to the darkenings. The darkenings here being all the sort of energies that rise up when you confront death and impermanence, when you confront all your fears. That's also what the cremation ground represents, all the kind of taboos, if you like, in your life. He'd teach them, he'd bring all those energies into his spiritual life. So instead of them being things that are kind of preventing spiritual progress, they enrich spiritual progress. So I took this as a sign in India. Ah, I need to really look into this. There's a lot of energy bound up with fear of death, fear of change, fear of transformation. I need to look right into this. So we all need to do that all the time, wherever we are. We've got to really consider, if you like, what we're doing with our life in the light of its ending, and just get exhilarated, if you like, in relation to that, and enrich our life, enrich our spiritual practice with that knowledge. So that form of Padmasambhava represented that. So the basic theme of this talk then is transformation. And when we go into groups, this is something to really kind of, you know, bring out. Well, what are the areas? Where do you think your gods and demons are? What do you think they are? Maybe they're the things I've mentioned. You can talk more about that. Maybe there are other things. Maybe there's some strong interest or passion or activity you have that you think you've got to sort of give up, and you if you become more involved in Buddhism. But it might be that there's a lot of energy in that that needs to be brought into Buddhist practice, brought into your meditation, brought into your spiritual endeavour. So have a look at that. And it's interesting, just, I've got to finish in a minute. Vajratara waved at me to finish. Pre-arranged, because I usually go on for a very long time. It's absolutely fascinating being in this space, talking like this, because of course this is an old church. This was a place where the old god was worshipped, and it's transformed. You know, and presumably, I mean, I don't want to be unkind. I mean, I would imagine it might have one time had rather an oppressive atmosphere. There's the confessional down there. I don't know what the vibes are like in there. But here, now, this has all been transformed into an environment where the individual spiritual practice is really treasured and cherished. You know, Christianity is very much associated with the repression and the wiping out of the old gods. Well, they won't do that. They won't do that. That's why in Buddhism we have to bring them on board, transform them so that they support our practice. So the symbolism of, you know, talking like this in this place is very, very powerful. Thank you very much.